Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's about 8:35, and I am so pleased to have a special guest with us tonight. I used to work not quite for him, not quite with him, but in the same general company many, many years ago. He was on the editorial side of Playboy magazine, and I was kind of on the advertising side, but we became kind of good friends and acquaintances, and he left there to really go out on his own and try his hand at being a real freelance writer and columnist, and he's moved into that in a pretty exciting way and doing a lot of political satire, which can be kind of chancy, especially under the current administration and mindset. Anyway, as I said at the top of the program, his comedy and his writing appears in places as disparate as NPR, the Los Angeles Times, Parenting Magazine, USA Today, The Daily News, Salon.com, Psychology Today, Newsweek, The New York Post. Oh, my God. Ladies and gentlemen, all I can say to all that is welcome to my special guest, Bruce Kluger.
Hey, David.
Hey, Bruce. Good to hear you.
Hey, listen, I was listening before, and maybe I'm getting old and forgot. What was the pun of the day? I heard all the advertising, but then I didn't hear the pun.
Oh, my God. Oh, thank you so much for asking. The Dave's Gone By Bad Pun of the Week. Not
pun of the Week. What was it this week? Yeah.
Which, by the way, was brought to us by Leviathan Media Group. It was, let's see, what joke did I make? It was...
Oh, it was the Taco Bell.
Yes, and I had to... No, it wasn't the... It was the Comedy Bell. I rang the Comedy Bell.
Right.
But, no, Taco Bell was not the joke. The joke was, the kids who were electrocuted?
No, you didn't do it.
Yes, I did. They weren't old enough to volt. Get it? V-O-L-T?
Yes. And I think maybe I groaned so loud that maybe I just blocked it. There you go.
And you even missed, like, the second joke I came in there with revolting. Get it? Revolting?
Must have blanked. It must be your dazzling style. You had to seduce.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bruce. And thanks. Anyway, but I don't want to spend all this time talking about my stuff. Actually, I do, but you're here, so I'm not going to talk about you. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
So, you left Playboy back when? This is about more than 10 years ago.
99.
Only 99. So you were there for quite a while.
I was there from 86 to 99. Mm-hmm. And it was great. It was a blast. You know, I remember once Christy Hefner actually at a company-wide meeting was talking about the challenge of it being a three-ring circus because every month was a different issue and every month was, you know, new programming on the channel and all that. And she called it a circus, and it was. It was a good, fun circus. But then when the carousel came around, every couple of years, the carousel would come around for me, and I'd say, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to get off the carousel and take a stab at this on my own. So I left in 99 and spent, I landed a few regular gigs playing off the beats that I had at Playboy, which were either celebrity interviews or home video. And that was pre-DVD.
Right, and these were regular, by the way, they're not adult videos. These were the basic movies
right,
coming out.
Right, they were real movies. We rarely did adult in the magazine. However, I should let you know that when I was covering video for Playboy, as you might recall, David, I would get screening copies of X-rated videos by the tons. And
I don't recall that. You never shared those with me, dude.
And I didn't?
No!
Every Friday, there was virtually a line outside my office. And what I found most sociologically and sexually interesting is the people lining up to, you know, borrow from this little lending library
purposes.
Were predominantly women.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. So I always found that interesting. It sort of goes back to the theory that they say that in department stores, most men's underwear, like 90%, is bought by women. So maybe there's a corollary there.
I don't know. I think that would be a little different. I mean, that's sort of a purchase. Women are the better shoppers, and they like to buy for their men. The porno thing, I don't know. Not that I'm an expert on such things, but...
No,
certainly not. But did you save a couple for me? You know, next time I see you.
Sure. But they're still at my office back on Fifth Avenue, and I don't know what to do about that.
Oh, well. You have an office on Fifth Avenue, you have no worries, dude. But anyway, talk to me still. You've been doing not just, I mean, you've been writing about parenting because you're a husband and father and all that kind of stuff, but you've also been trying to make your way as a political satirist,
right.
Columnist, pundit sort of thing.
Right.
Not
no,
the easiest
I sort of stumbled into that. And incidentally, no, the Playboy office was at Fifth Avenue. I work out of my home. I moved into doing op-eds for a couple of newspapers, and one of the catches and one of the the challenges of op-eds is, of course, they are based on the events of the day. And unlike articles that you pitch to other magazines or to newspapers, you don't write pitches, you know, a two- or three-paragraph idea and pass it to an op-ed editor, because they are fluid. They move with the news. So what winds up happening is that you, you know, whereas you would expend X amount of energy to write a 600-word pitch, you expend X plus 4 energy to write the actual 800-word essay. And so you wind up, or one winds up, with a lot of stuff that's never bought because its time has passed. But in the process of doing that, I found that I had sort of a good feel for not doing a serious op-ed, or perhaps doing a seriously written op-ed, but perhaps a serious op-ed with a funny spin.
Actually, one thing that I am curious about, since you do have to do that, and your pieces are relatively short, even on the radio, and I don't know if the amount has changed between when you first started doing this freelance work and now, but of the what percentage would you say of the
stuff
you
write? Somebody asked me the other day. I'm now, well, now it's different because after a couple years, USA Today has now made me a member of their board of contributors, which means that they, you know, send out a memo that says, hey, Jessica Lynch is being released this week. Does anybody have a spin on it? So now the percentage has gotten significantly better, because now I can call my editor at USA Today and say, hey, how about if I do something, and just knock the idea around. But for a good couple of years, I would say I was batting between 250 and 300, which means that
for every, I think I can figure that math out. For every four pieces you write, one would get sold.
Between one out of four, or one out of three, and it's, you know, naturally it's frustrating. But interestingly, it is like baseball in that 333 is considered good, but it's tough. And you can't even rest back and say, well, that's okay, because then when I become famous, I can release an anthology of all the pieces, because, you know, we have a very funny take, for example, on stem cells. And
they had a rather amusing take on you, by the way.
It was perfect for that week. But if you were to put it in a book form and, you know, put stuff in, it's hard to get the public thinking about stem cells again. It's quite interesting how fluid the news is, and how much you retain and how much you don't retain. I was watching a special the other night on Gianni Versace, a documentary, and to my complete astonishment, I said, what was the name of the man who shot Gianni Versace? And do you remember at the time, he was on the cover of news magazines. He led the news every single... Do you remember, actually, David?
I remember her being shot, or him being shot. I don't remember... Well, his name.
Yeah, his name was Andrew Kinnanen.
Okay.
But at that time, it was on the lips. So, in other words, I say, as I'm trying to say, the backlog of stuff that's not used becomes, you know, it was good for the time, and there that they will all sit on my computer.
Well, yeah, the ultimate irony, I got out of the library the last Michael Moore book, in which he just basically blasts and excoriates the Bush administration, which you would figure would still be timely, except he wrote it and it was published probably about 3 months before 9/11.
Right.
So, you know, I got this book out, and it just, I couldn't even read it, because it was like there was no context anymore. Everything he was saying was true in its way, but it didn't, there was no reason to read it after 9/11. It had to be updated in every which way.
Well, interesting, the 9/11 played a factor in one facet of my the work that I do now. In the course of writing op-ed, somewhere around 2000, I became friends with a man named David Slavin, because we both have two daughters, very close in age. We do a lot of play dates and parties together, and he lives down the block. And he's a very funny guy. He's a voiceover artist. And I was writing one op-ed for some place somewhere. Was the Los Angeles Times, and I know that his sense of humor was along the lines of mine, so I said, what do you think of this? And he gave me some tweaking that was not only so good, but so improved it, that we tried our hand at a piece together. And, you know, I will be the first to admit that before this experience, I think that writing, for the most part, is a non-collaborative craft. It's a very difficult craft to do by oneself, let alone in the collaborative process. It was quite the opposite with David. He and I just finished each other's sentences, and it was a joy. So we began writing op-eds together, and vis-a-vis 9/11, we had had a column that was pretty popular on Salon.com called Memo to George, in which we wrote internal memos from George's staff, Bush's staff, which was always fun because you could ascribe to them all of the villainry that, you know, one suspects,
right,
but do it in their own voices. And we were on a pretty good roll, and we were a premium item on the web and on their website, and then 9/11 happened, and suddenly all the rules changed about making fun of the President of the United States.
Well, that is where I kind of wanted to take the direction of this, because I did want to know, in the past couple of years, you have encountered censorship. You haven't encountered even pre-censorship, people pre-censoring themselves,
right,
or their newspapers or columns to not run into trouble. Can you give us, without necessarily naming names, but do if you can, an example or two of what you've run into?
Well, no, it all depends on your artist, on your audience. There are, for example, certain types of articles at USA Today, because it's the, you know, if you think about it, one of the only national newspapers we have, that would step up to an issue, but perhaps not in the sarcastic or vitriolic, well, certainly not the vitriolic, well, I shouldn't say vitriolic, but in a smart-assy way that Dave and I did on Salon,
mm-hmm,
or that only has two guest columns a day, so maybe they usually don't lead to satirical pieces. NPR is another example. NPR has, where Dave and I have predominantly been concentrating for the past year on National Public Radio and All Things Considered, and it has been a gas. But a peculiar problem that NPR experiences is that they are constantly being accused by the political right of being a tool for the political left, which they're certainly not. They are, as far as I'm concerned, fair and balanced. But they come off as a commodity, as someone who expresses the view of the left, because the industry is so awash in right now that they sound more left than they are. But there have been instances in which Dave and I have a nice sketch poking fun at, I don't know, maybe the rebuilding effort in Iraq, and it might be appropriate for a piece on NPR to take a, you know, jab at, the French and the Germans coming on and saying, let us be part of the rebuilding effort, when they were so against the war in the first place. But then if you step over to the line to implicate maybe, what are they called?
Halliburton. Yeah.
Or someone else. You suddenly shift the focus of the piece to a real stab at Bush, where you were getting yucks before making fun of the French. And, of course, everybody likes to make fun of the French.
Well, of course.
So, for those things.
And then again, everybody likes a good stab at Bush, but that brings us back to the porn issue. No, I'm
right,
sorry.
Right, there you go.
Just diverting with sarcasm there.
I could always set my watch to those comments.
Actually, the thing is, we've got less than 2 minutes left in this segment, and I did promise people that you were going to tell a little bit about your feud with Bill O'Reilly. So let's
cap
with that.
I wrote an article about how rude Bill O'Reilly was. I published it in USA Today, and just that he was rude and ill-mannered, that he doesn't let people express their opinions, and he apparently began calling my home, or his people began calling my home, 9 o'clock that morning. He was ranting about me all day on the radio and invited me on his program, and I bit. I took him up on his offer. I had to think about it all day, and then I realized that if I did in fact go on the show, the worst case scenario was that he'd make mincemeat of me, and I thought, you know what, that's okay, because then he'll only serve to illustrate my point. So I went on his show and got to tell the man to his face that, you know, he was ill-mannered and rude, and he called me a weasel, which I was sort of flattered about, because he called George Clooney a weasel, and hey, you know,
right,
I could be compared to George Clooney. That's not a bad day, right?
Right, exactly.
So then I wrote another article for the Los Angeles Times about what it was like to appear on the O'Reilly Factor and how it's all a setup and how the man doesn't permit you to talk, yet they use almost psycho-ops on you beforehand. It was a very unpleasant, and that infuriated him. He was furious that I would go and publish a piece about what it was like to be a sort of backstage look at him.
So how has that wound up rather quickly between since then? Interestingly,
Roger Ailes, the CEO of Fox, wrote a letter to the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, sort of dirty tricking me, saying that the only reason that I was writing nasty articles about Bill O'Reilly was because I wanted a job at Fox and was turned down, which was patently untrue. But again, he's figured out that I'm trying to ride on, you know, his name popularity, because now when he complains about me on the air, he doesn't mention me by name. He just says, the fellow who's making his living by trashing me. And I would like to correct him and say, no, I'm trying to make a living by trashing you, Bill. I just can't make enough money doing it.
Well, keep trashing him. Keep trashing all the people that you want to, whether I agree or anybody agrees with you or not, because that's what it's all about. I want to thank you so much for not trashing me on my own program. I wanted to ask you so much other stuff, and there were like a list of other questions.
Well, we'll do it another time.
Please, Bruce. It's been great. I want to thank you again so much. Bruce Kluger, ladies and gentlemen.
My pleasure, David.
Look for his pieces with David Slavin on NPR. Look for his stuff in the LA Times and in USA Today. And just look for him around town with his two girls. And if you're an O'Reilly fan, you know where to hit him. So thank you, Bruce.
Thanks, David.
Have a great night.
You too.